This hour of the Kevin Miller Show is brought to you by MinutemanRx.com. American families, American veterans, taking care of Americans, fighting for America.
Do I want to send one of my sons or your son to fight to regain Mosul? Who should want to stop them more? Maybe the people who live there.
There are a lot of groups out there that probably have more advanced immediate plans directed against the United States.
Fighting for Idaho.
Pride is an important celebration for the LGBT community. It's important to be out and be proud of who you are and be safe in your community and show everyone that we're part of Boise.
Fighting for you.
Portugal scored a devastating goal to tie the game.
Team USA settling for a 2-2 draw.
For Team USA, we're going all the way.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the morning on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the morning. Phone numbers 580-5436, 580-KIDO. One of the most distinguished guests that we've had on this program, we're joined by Homer Hickam, best known for his memoir Rocket Boys, the popular movie October Sky. Mr. Hickam has been a coal miner, Vietnam combat veteran, scuba instructor, NASA engineer, and now a best-selling author from God's country, North Alabama, to the Treasure Valley here in Idaho. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, Kevin. By the way, if you hear cat and dog sounds in the background, my wife and I volunteer every Friday morning to clean cat cages out for forgotten felines here in Huntsville, Alabama. So that will explain the odd sounds in the background.
Having spent 2 years of my life at WVNN in Athens, I have a great affinity for your hometown, sir, where you live now, from the Von Braun Center to Madison to Huntsville to Athens. What a great place that you're living in.
Yeah, I agree. North Alabama, we kind of like to keep it a little bit of a secret, but this is a nice place to live. Of course, I was born and raised in West Virginia, and I still get back up there from time to time, but we do love our home here in Rocket City, Huntsville, Alabama. By the way, I'd like to shout out to Chief Warrant Officer Gordon Williams, who lives in Boise and hopefully is listening in, and we served together in the 4th Infantry Division in Vietnam, and he was a great war hero in Vietnam and also in Korea. So, Chief, I hope you're having a good day.
And I hope you're listening, Chief. So that's a lot of trouble if you're not, but, you know, I'll tell you, your area, sir, having lived in both, this area very similar, except we don't have the rockets everywhere. But let's talk a little bit about your love of space, your new book, Crater True Blood, and has the country lost its zeal to explore something that has mesmerized you for years, space?
Yeah, it has a little bit. And, you know, as a country, I think we're looking inward an awful lot and worrying about social programs and all that, which, of course, we need to do, and the poor people. But at the same time, in order to be a great country, you have to do great things. And we think naturally here in Huntsville, and hopefully a lot of folks are around the country, that we really ought to be doing more in space in a more organized way. Right now, I don't think NASA really knows. It doesn't get good direction, so it doesn't really know what it should be doing, and so it's spinning its wheels an awful lot. We're real happy that there are some commercial companies like SpaceX, headed up by Elon Musk, who is very organized and knows what it wants to do, but ultimately for the American people, I think NASA has to step up, figure it out, and let's get some good leadership, and let's go back to the moon and
Mars and
do these things that we want to do. You know?
Right, and by the way, Huntsville, or as they pronounce it there, Huntsville, is the home of it really left an impression on me there. Is the home of Space Camp, where kids from across the country get to go and learn about space and learn about science.
Well, it sure is, Kevin. As a matter of fact, I'm on the board for Space Camp. And right now, I mean, the summertime is our busiest time. And we've got hundreds of kids and adults, teachers and that come in here during the summer, but also all year round. I hope folks will go out and look at spacecamp.com and teachers and see about coming here and sending their kids here, because it's really amazing. A lot of the kids we get, I think, are picked on at school because they're kind of nerdy and they are they don't feel like they're part of the group. And they come here and all of a sudden they're with their peers, and it's just amazing to see them. They become bright lights, and they carry that back to their schools, and they in a lot of ways helps them have a good life. We've had kids who've gone on to become astronauts, but all kinds of leaders across the country. It doesn't have to be in space, but yeah, space camp by all means. Let's try to get a lot of folks from Boise to come here.
They would love it. It's awesome.
They would.
Yeah, I've been to the museum several times, and there's such a dynamic there, and I think it's infectious when you have these big believers, and then we see what we've done as far as the rockets and Wernher von Braun and just what we were, which would give us a great glimpse of what we could be again, and even bigger considering the technology we had during the space race is, I mean, we have more computing chips in our phone now. Could you imagine if we had that same effort today?
Yeah, and the main thing is to try to get focused, and NASA has lost its focus. It doesn't get good leadership from the top on down, so NASA's got to figure out what it wants to do and go out and sell that to the American public. And that's one of the reasons, you know, I've mentioned I'm known for writing Rocket Boys and then the movie October Sky, and I apologize for not actually being Jake Gyllenhaal, by the way. But also, I've written a lot of books about a lot of different things. I'm kind of well known for writing the World War II series, Josh Thurlow, but it's come to me that we need to do something to energize young people in space and science. So that's why I've written this trilogy of books about this young man named Crater Trueblood, who lives on the moon 100 years from now. And they are entertaining books that parents, grandparents, teachers should think about getting these for their children ages 10 through 18. Adults like them too, but I wrote them for young adults who I think maybe it might turn them on to space and science, because they enjoy meeting Crater and all the folks that he deals with. And also I sneak in a little bit about responsibility and honor and duty and all of these attributes that the kids need to be kind of told about, and telling it in an entertaining way is the best way that I have to try to get out to kids and let them know about, all the engineers and scientists I know lead great lives. They have fun lives because they're up every morning and they have things to do that are important. And so I'm hoping that we can peel off some of these kids and get them into the sciences.
What I don't understand is kids are so into technology today, sir. It would seem obvious to me that they would be, it would be a natural to jump into the sciences, to jump into the technology, because they live on these computers where you were all about the slide rule.
Well, they're into using technology, but are they into actually learning how the technology works? And to me, of course, that's the most fascinating part of technology. How does this thing work? I mean, what magic is it that makes it work? It's not magic. It is technology. And to if I can write some books that gets the Crater Trueblood, he starts as a 12-year-old working in the helium-3 mines on the moon, and we watch him over this three-book trilogy grow to 21. He is a natural engineer, and so everything he does, he kind of figures out how things work and through his engineering ability. And so I hope to get kids interested in that and say, oh, that sounds like fun. I'd like to do that. I'd like to learn that. And ultimately, why are we here? We're here to learn things and then take what we learn and for the benefit of all mankind, just as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had on the Apollo limb lander. That's why we do these things.
Mr. Hickam with us here, Homer Hickam at 580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the morning. I got to ask you about a couple programs. What about Skylab? What did you think of Skylab?
Well, Skylab was our first space station. As a matter of fact, we have the engineering model of Skylab at the Space and Rocket Center, which is where Space Camp is here in Huntsville, Alabama. It was managed out of Huntsville. The cool thing about Skylab to me was that it lost its solar panels on the way up, and had our astronauts had to go up and fix it, sort of like the Hubble Space Telescope later on. And all that work was done in a place that I spent a lot of time when I worked for NASA, and that's the a big underwater tank called the Neutral Buoyancy Simulator. So that was our first space station, and we learned an awful lot about it, and it ultimately led into Space Lab and then now the International Space Station.
What was it like working in that that buoyancy place?
Well, it was fascinating. I didn't start working for NASA until 1981, which was the shuttle era, so I missed Skylab. But I was there for the Hubble Space Telescope when we realized it was nearsighted. We knew, oh, this is going to be fun because we're going to have to go up and fix this plane thing. And so I ended up spending dozens of hours in the suit underwater trying to figure out how we would go fix it. And then Story Musgrave and Kathy Thornton and that crew came in to the neutral buoyancy simulator, and we trained them. Literally, we were underwater for hundreds and hundreds of hours trying to figure out how we'd go up and fix the Hubble. I think that turned out to be NASA's finest hour since Apollo, was the ability for the shuttle to go up and dock with the Hubble Space Telescope, and then for our crews to actually go out and fix this very complex and very delicate machine. And now the knowledge that we've gotten from Hubble, you can attribute that right back to the engineers who figured out how to go up there and fix it, the brave astronauts who actually did it, and our old water tank in Huntsville.
Well, let's continue on with a stroll down memory lane, and then we'll get to the shuttle program. I'm amazed at the technology, and a lot of people maybe under 35 or maybe under 30 don't understand the Voyager program. I remember as a little boy, much less of a passion that you have for space, but just being amazed at these little tiny satellites with, couldn't even describe the technology, that have journeyed now out of our solar system, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2.
Yeah, I mean, they had the energy of like a light bulb. They're so far out now that they're still talking to us. Amazingly, yeah. They are moving out now into the outer solar system, into the Oort cloud. And a lot of people say, well, they've already left the solar system, but they're still in the debris field left over from the creation of our solar system. But we have some other robotic systems out there. But New Horizon next year will arrive at Pluto, and which is still a, as far as I'm concerned, it's still a planet and always will be.
I was going to ask you that follow-up question on that. I'm glad.
It's going to be at Pluto and its moon Chiron, and we're going to learn an awful lot of new things about this. It wouldn't surprise me once we have a look at Pluto that we'll probably upgrade it again to a planet. It can be I don't care if they can call it a dwarf planet or a mini planet, but it's not just an asteroid floating out there. It is a world. And it's one that, to me, I can't believe it. As a kid, look, I was born in 1943, and I grew up reading a lot of science fiction, and I couldn't imagine that I would live in the age where we would actually have a robotic probe to Pluto, and it's going to send us back pictures, and we're going to see what it looks like. And we've looked at all these worlds like Titan and Europa. To me, they're fascinating, in a lot of ways more fascinating than Mars. Titan has oceans of methane. Europa probably has a water ocean underneath the several miles of ice. To me, those worlds need exploring as well. So there's a lot of things that NASA could do that it's not doing. As I said, it's spinning a lot of wheels, and the engineers that work for NASA are very frustrated because they don't have good direction. And ultimately, it's up to the American people to say, hey, we want to do this. We're interested. And I actually think the American people are behind the space program. They're kind of spread out, and they're not very vocal, and they need to get more vocal and say, hey, we want a real space program. And again, that's why I've written these Crater True Blood books, and I hope that that parents and grandparents and teachers will kind of let their kids know about them and give them as gifts. And they can find those all out, by the way, on homerhickam.com.
Is it because we just became so used to the shuttle and it was more like a bus trip than the big trips to the moon or a possible trip to Mars that perhaps we are appreciation for space and the sacrifice and the engineering brilliance that made that happen has gone away?
Yeah, I don't think NASA did a very good job during the shuttle program of expressing and carrying across the excitement. Those of us who were in the program, I spent some years training the first Japanese astronauts. We flew them on Spacelab J, and that was all very exciting for those of us who were inside the agency, but we did a really poor job of letting the American people know about these exciting things that we were doing during the shuttle program. So now here we are post-shuttle. What are we going to do next? Nobody really knows. They talk about this and that. Here at Marshall, they're building a great big rocket called the SLS, the Space Launch System. But it has no mission, and so until it does, the American people are not going to care. And it's why I'm really excited about Elon Musk and the SpaceX. They're doing some very dramatic things, having their rockets completely reusable, bringing them back, having them land tail first, just like they used to do in the with Buck Rogers and Tom Corbett and the Space Cadets and all that kind of thing. I love what they're doing. I think NASA needs to get busy building. We don't need to build chemical rockets anymore. We know how to do that. What NASA needs to do is to start building some big bad rockets using nuclear energy or fusion energy or ion energy, and let the commercial companies build the chemical rockets.
Mr. Hickam, can you stand by for a moment?
Absolutely.
All right, more coming up.
On Hannity, weekday afternoons at 3 on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
We are still a leader in space exploration, but frankly, I have been pushing NASA to revamp its vision.
I know you and me don't exactly see eye to eye on certain things, but he isn't my hero.
Kevin Miller in the morning, 580 KIDO. Best-selling author Homer Hickam with us at 580 KIDO. Mr. Hickam, we go to the mission to Mars. What do you make of that, and do we have to go back to the moon first?
Well, I'm a big believer in going back to the moon and actually living there. There are a lot of resources on the moon, that, such as helium-3, which turns out to be the perfect fuel for fusion reactors, which we've made huge strides in that technology just recently. The moon has such rare earths as materials such as titanium. We also believe that probably we've had asteroids made of pure gold hit the moon. So there are a lot of assets and resources on the moon. Plus, it's a perfect place to put a big telescope on the far side where we can look out across the universe and perhaps image other planets and see if they've got an atmosphere and oceans on. And right now we can infer it, but we can't really see them. And so the moon to me is a more fascinating place to go to send people than Mars. Mars, we're doing fine with robots and so on, and it's an interesting planet, but it's very dry, and it also, we can't breathe the atmosphere. So for me, the moon is easily accessible. It's only a 250,000 miles away, and we can get up there in a couple of days. And to me, that's where we ought to start with our focus. President Obama says that he wanted NASA to give a new vision. Well, I'm sorry, NASA won't do it. NASA's a federal agency, and it's waiting for direction from the top. A lot of us folks out here are trying to give NASA a vision, but first they have to listen, and right now they're not listening.
Mr. Hickam, what about all that debris up there? Is there anything that we can do in the atmosphere so it doesn't hurt the Soyuz or the SpaceX or the space station? We got a bunch of junk up there.
Yeah, all that space junk that's up there. Yeah, there have been several proposals of ways to go up there and get the space junk out of the way. Space is a really big place. So, but there are favorite parking spots for satellites in geosynchronous orbit and so on. For our communications satellites, that we really don't want a lot of space debris. And also at around 250 miles where we tend to orbit our space stations. So, we need to work on that for what's already up there. But more importantly, probably now, is to design satellites that don't come apart so easily. And there are ways of doing that. We have that technology, and so we're trying to remember that when we build the new satellites, and also give the Chinese and everybody else this technology so that they will also do the same thing. The Chinese and the Russians are the prime offenders in the space junk. They send their satellites up there without any kind of protection. After a while, There's extra fuel propellant inside these things. Those tanks get hot. They tear apart. They literally explode, and that's what's causing most of the debris. It's not us. It's the Russians and the Chinese.
Mr. Hickam, finally, why go into writing? I mean, you've done so much. What was the appeal of that? And on your website, homerhickam.com, you have advice for writers. Everybody has a story in them. Why write when you've already done everything?
Well, I would have probably, if it hadn't been for Sputnik and me getting into the space business and building rockets, I would have probably become an English professor. That was really my orientation as a kid, was reading and writing. So I simply came back to my original roots in a lot of ways. But when I worked for NASA, before I wrote Rocket Boys and October Sky and all that, I had a best-selling book called Torpedo Junction about, of all things, the German U-boats up and down the East Coast. So writing and rockets, that's kind of my thing. And so now with this new series, I get to do both in a way.
Well, and we want to thank you for your service in Vietnam and thank you for making yourself available. You know, I've read your works, and again, knowing about Huntsville and the VBC and all that, it's great to talk to somebody from there.
Well, same here, Kevin. Come back. We missed you. Come on back to Huntsville and bring some folks. And I don't know if you've been out here since we had the big Saturn V put inside in the Davison Hall, and we also have an Apollo 16. Moon capsule, and of course Space Camp and Space Academy for kids 10 through 18 years old, and Adult Space Academy as well. So spacecamp.com is where you look for all that, and for my books it's homerhickam.com, and we appreciate parents and grandparents who might want to take a look at the Crater True Blood books with the idea of giving them as gifts to kids who might need just a little bit of push towards science and space.
And you're in the right place. I mean, when you drive across the state, there's a big rocket. When you go into the airport, it's all about space and certainly the sacrifices. And, you know, it brings back so many memories. So we are urging people. And, yes, Mr. Hickam, I am going to get back there. And it's just a beautiful place. And I'll bring some folks with me.
I wish you would. And every year, the Space and Rocket Center, that's where Space Camp is, gets better and better. And so if you haven't been back for a few years, it's all changed with a lot more displays and so on. And we're trying to make it better every year.
Do you still have the SR-71 outside?
It is. And that's one of the things that we hope to do to make that a better display as well. It's just sitting out there. And we don't like the fact that it's just sitting out in the rain and everything. So we're going to try to get it fixed and fixed up and better displayed. And that's why we brought the Saturn V inside. That's with a real functional Saturn V left over from the Apollo glory days. And it was sitting outside, the raccoons were building nests in and everything else. So we were able to build a great big building now and put the Saturn V inside and display it in all its glory. It's just amazing to see, really. And so we just try to keep things going. And in a lot of ways, Huntsville, we have such a great heritage here at Rocket City, USA, and we love to have guests. And and people, like I say, we kind of kept it a little bit of secret, and maybe we need to stop that because it is a beautiful area, not only to come visit, but to live.
You're right about that, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right, take care. There you have it. Bye-bye. Homer Hickam with us. What a remarkable man. By the way, not only author, not only engineer, but received the Bronze Star for his service in Vietnam. Outstanding. You're listening to 580 KIDO.
News.
Dave Ramsey, weekdays noon till 3 on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the morning. Hard to believe Michael Jackson died 5 years ago today. Live to the Middle East now, Emily Wither joins us from Fox News Radio. Emily, good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Well, just remembering the King of Pop. Any Michael Jackson memories for you?
I do actually have a Michael Jackson memory. So I used to work as a music journalist, and the day that Michael Jackson died was my first proper day on the job as a music journalist, and I was at Glastonbury Music Festival. I don't know if you guys have heard of that, but it's a festival in England, and it's massive. It's think thousands of people. And news quickly spread that Michael Jackson had died, and here I was the first day on the job as a music journalist, and there was the biggest music story pretty much in the last decade. So it was a bit of a stressful day for me.
Well, you've come a long way from covering music to covering the Middle East.
Well, I used to do very hard news, and I left for a couple of years to do music, and then I missed news, so I came back.
Well, certainly you've got a lot of news going on with the latest in Iraq and the impact it's having in the region. What's the latest?
There is more fighting today around that oil refinery, Kevin, and I know we've spoken about it a lot the last couple of times that we've spoken, and that's because the militants just want to get their hands on it. It's called Beji Oil Refinery. It's the country's largest. It's about 155 miles north of the capital, Baghdad. And the government seemed to have been fighting back and defending it, but militants yet again have launched a dawn raid this morning to try and seize it. If they manage to capture it, it would hugely disrupt the country's supply, because it accounts for around a third or a fourth of the country's domestic oil refining capability. So the militants see it as quite a big prize for them. In terms of elsewhere, what the militants have been up to in terms of seizing territory, they are still in control, it seems, of the country's only border crossing between Jordan and Iraq. And the Jordanians have started to get a little bit concerned that ISIS, this militant group, have set their sights on Jordan next. So they have been beefing up the security presence along their border. And these militants also are in control of nearly all of the border crossings in and out of Syria from Iraq. The government claimed to have recaptured two of these crossing points yesterday, but that's something that's being denied by the militants. In terms of whether they've reached Baghdad, that's a question that a lot of people have been asking. They haven't made it to the capital, and I think it's unlikely that they will advance much further, because the capital is very well protected, as are some of the southern cities, which are Shiite-dominated.
Emily, do they have the means, the capability, or even the gumption to maybe encircle Baghdad?
They have the capability to definitely encircle it in terms of capturing smaller towns and cities around it. They have already done that in the sense that they've captured Fallujah to the west. They've captured some smaller towns and cities to the north. But in terms of taking Baghdad, they just do not have the numerical majority to do that. Iraq's security forces, along with the police, number over a million. So we're talking, you know, a big force here. And when it comes to these militants, they have much less in terms of numbers. I mean, we don't know for sure exactly how many ISIS fighters there are. It's estimated in Iraq there's 3,000 to 5,000, but they've also been joined on the ground by many Sunni militia groups. So in total, they probably have 10,000 to 15,000 fighters. So, I mean, there's just no way in terms of numbers that they would be able to do this, unless there was a much larger Sunni backlash with more groups, more Sunni groups turning their back against supporting the government of Nouri al-Maliki.
Emily, I heard Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Meet the Press this weekend, and he said he really questioned the United States' strategy by saying, look, your enemies are fighting each other, the Sunnis and the Shia. The last thing you want to do is help your enemies by helping Iran.
That's the complicated position for the U.S. at the moment, and I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen a reluctance for them to get involved in airstrikes. We did hear from Secretary of State John Kerry, who has been shuttling back and forth to and from Iraq. He visited Baghdad, where he met with Sunni and Shiite leaders. He also met with the Kurdish president to the north in the semi-autonomous region of for the Kurds up there, and he said that if the U.S. was to carry out airstrikes, it would be to target this militant group, because they see the militant group becoming a danger beyond the borders of Iraq and Syria. He wouldn't say that the U.S. would carry out airstrikes to support the government of Nouri al-Maliki. And that's the important point here. The U.S. is stressing that any action isn't in support of the government. It's to just tackle these militants. And I think that's the U.S. making it clear that they're not choosing a side here in what is increasingly turning into a sectarian battle. It's not a civil war in Iraq, but because of Iraq's history, it certainly has the potential to go that way. And you have Iran, who is very much backing the Shiite leader Nouri al-Maliki, which makes it even more complicated for the U.S. who are technically fighting against Iran in Syria. They are backing Sunni rebels who are fighting Iranian forces who are backing up the government of President Assad. So it just creates a very messy, tangled web for the U.S. So I think many aren't surprised about their reluctance to get involved.
And yet you still have the violence going on. Finally, what do the militants hope to do with the oil? I mean, they can't put it on the market and sell it, can they?
They have been trying to sell it. Huh. In the east, in Syria, they control some of the oil fields there, and I'm sure they're making money off of it. I mean, this is one of the ways that the militants try to make their money. And they have been trying to capture these sorts of strategic places in Iraq as well. They tried to capture a very large dam in Iraq, and they've also, as I said, been trying to capture this oil refinery. They've also been robbing banks. There were reports that they robbed a bank in Mosul, and also they've been looting Iraqi warehouses of weaponry, which they are then carrying back over the border into Syria. So these militants are clever in the sense that they are fighting to capture territory, but they're also thinking ahead of how they're going to make money and sustain their operation.
Finally, your favorite Michael Jackson song.
Oh, my goodness, that's quite a question. I like the one where he's dancing in the graveyard. Which one's that?
Thriller?
Yes, Thriller. And I have something else to add about Michael Jackson, actually. I was recently in Munich in Germany, and this was only a couple of months ago, and there was a huge shrine to Michael Jackson in the center of Munich, and it was very well kept. It was bursting with fresh flowers, photographs. There were candles that had been lit. And apparently this is a shrine that fans of Michael Jackson still visit on a weekly basis in Munich. It's down a back street because the authorities won't allow them to have an official shrine. So, I mean, Michael Jackson's still obviously being remembered all over the world.
Amazing. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
6:50, Kevin Miller in the morning. Time for traffic at 5.
On Hannity, weekday afternoons at 3 on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Uruguay star player Luis Suarez seen on video taking a bite out of Italian defender Giorgio Chiellini's shoulder in about the 80th minute of the match. This isn't the first chomping incident for Suarez. He was suspended for biting against the Netherlands in 2010 and in England in 2013.
And there we have it. So today it's going to be Michael Jackson and biting songs. Thank you, Ramaya, for that brilliant piece of audio. So what kind of sport is it where biting is acceptable? Oh, please don't tell me about Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield. Kevin Miller with you here at 580KIDO, 580KIDO.com. Lots of great video and audio on the Kevin Miller Hot List, the IRS Gets It edition. By now you've seen the testimony, and if you haven't, there's three must-see videos on that particular hot list where you see the arrogance of the IRS commissioner, the sheer disapproval, the sheer disrespect for Congress. And where does that come from? It comes from his boss, Obama, and Eric Holder. And I know what people say, Kevin, we're all depressed. Kevin, we're all worried. We can't ignore the facts. When the Internal Revenue Service, all of a sudden, no, I'm not going to give him the benefit of the doubt, suddenly destroys 2 years of hard drive evidence. And you heard Trey Gowdy on this program yesterday, 580KIDO, Kevin Miller, where he's saying, look, if you destroy the evidence in a civil or criminal case, the jury can speculate, rightfully so, that you did it because it was damaging to you. And the smirky, snide, condescending remarks of the Internal Revenue Service commissioner, is this any way to respect a body of Congress? Last time I looked, the IRS was not in the Constitution. And what you see here is the pushing of the power with the presidency. Hopefully, somebody's going to fight back, because how many times have you, your loved ones, a friend of yours, been audited? If you lose 2 years worth of paperwork, what happens to you? Shouldn't it be the same for our government? 580 KIDO coming up next. Russ Fulcher will join us. We'll talk about the state GOP. But first, traffic. It's good to meet Larry. Coming up next, former GOP candidate for governor, State Senator Russ Fulcher. Enough said there on that one, right? Plus, continuing to remember Michael Jackson. K. Millie, 580 KIDO. Good morning.